The Anton Savage Show with Kearys.ie on News Talk.
I'm joined this morning by journalist and author Valerie Cox, by Gerard Howland, public affairs consultant and Irish Times columnist and news reporter at independent.ie, Gabia Gadaviscatia, to look through all of the stories that are worth talking about this Sunday morning. And the one that has been, of course, prime now for several days, several weeks, several months, continues to be the main story, that being immigration and the various different rows, complaints, concerns, public order issues and policy challenges that it is providing. And where we might start is with, Gabia, your paper or sister paper or family paper, or whatever is the correct term for the Sunday Indo. Ireland Thinks poll, and there's much that we will talk about at the Ireland Thinks poll this morning because it covers a multitude. But very interesting that there is a relatively benign attitude, if not a positive attitude, towards Ireland adopting a Rwanda-style deportation policy.
Yeah, really quite, I suppose, bizarre claims, if you'll entertain me to describe them that way. And findings from the Sunday Independent Ireland Thinks poll, you know, half of pollsters believe that there should be harder checks around the border. And actually, more interestingly, 52% of Sinn Féin supporters think there should be checkpoints to limit the amount of asylum seekers that are coming here from the UK. And if you let me just go through some of the other statistics.
Now, just before you go through them, because that's significant. 52% of Sinn Féin supporters eager to see border checkpoints between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland.
Yes. So how does that square? I don't know. When asked who or what is the most responsible for the increased numbers of asylum seekers to Ireland in the past few months, 39% say the Irish government. Do you think asylum seekers who have arrived here from the UK should, 82%, be returned to the UK? Do you believe that the increased numbers of asylum seekers in Ireland are coming here to avoid deportation under the Rwanda policy? 72% say yes. And do you believe this claim from Helen McEntee that 80% of people coming seeking asylum in Ireland are coming here across the border? 53% say yes. But actually, what I think is the most staggering finding of them all is the poll, all of the polls, I think, but Sunday Independent Ireland Thinks poll does is every time they give you a list of topics and they say, what's the most important issues that you have to deal with at the moment? Number one is housing, 54%. 41% is immigration, which is up by 15%. And Kevin Cunningham, who's the managing director of Ireland Thinks, he makes the point that this is 17 points higher than the immediate aftermath of the Dublin riots. And if you can remember the atmosphere that was so charged after that. So really, really very interesting findings. And I think as we look into the locals and Europeans, they're coming up now in a month's time. Like, that puts immigration firmly on the agenda for those.
And it looks like, Gerard Howland, the government has totally lost the dressing room when it comes to immigration.
Totally. I mean, these little blue tents are the equivalent on Dublin 2 and Dublin 4 of the small boats in the English channels. They have completely upset our politics. They are the focus of it. And I think, you know, strategic mistakes were made 2 or 3 years ago by the government, and it's too late now to turn that around. And major tactical mistakes have been made in the last 2 or 3 weeks. It has, in short order, ended the honeymoon, such as it was, of Taoiseach Simon Harris. He made a major blunder in clearing Mount Street of several hundred tents, only to discover that within 48 hours there were several dozens more tents in another place. He only displaced the problem, he didn't address it, and the powerlessness of the state is dangerously exposed.
And do you lay the fault at this at Roderick O'Gorman's door for failing to provide accommodation, and therefore you get, as you describe them, the little blue tents in urban centres that act as flashpoints and attention? Or is it that the government has failed to convince people that immigration is a good thing? Or is it simply so great that there is no solution?
No, it is not so great, as there might not have been a solution, but it's too late for a solution now. I think if there's anyone who comes out of this with any integrity, it is in fact Roderick O'Gorman, because for more than 2 years before Ukraine started, as it started, as it got into full swing in terms of tens of thousands of Ukrainians coming here, he very insistently appealed to his colleagues in government for a whole of government approach to this. Then Taoiseach Micheál Martin wasn't interested. Subsequently, Taoiseach Leo Varadkar wasn't interested. And what they were doing was they were keeping that problem in his O'Gorman's bailiwick, which, as they saw it, that was a politically successful manoeuvre for them, as it was for a year or two. But now it's exploded, it has expanded. This is washing up all around them, first to their oxters, now to their necks, and here we are. But it was Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael in government who refused any effective cooperation with the one department of integration that was clearly being overwhelmed. Why? Because they didn't want the bother of the problem.
And it's interesting to see, Valerie, how much the public attitude, according to this poll, has now hardened. Half of people saying that they would support the deportation of asylum seekers to an independent third country like Rwanda.
Yeah, but you see, there's two things to this, really. First of all, they're talking about the deportation of asylum seekers en masse. But it's not as simple as that, because a lot of the asylum seekers coming here are coming from awful backgrounds where their lives are in danger, their families are in danger. I mean, 8 years ago, I worked on the Greek islands as a volunteer with the refugees, people coming ashore in those tiny boats, escaping awful things, mostly Syria at the time. And so many of them died. They died in the shallows, even after crossing the waters over from Turkey. And at that stage, Europe should have been getting involved. They didn't. And what's happening now is we're seeing the consequences of that. And then lots of other people from countries that are, you know, where they're not in danger. Of course, they're coming as economic immigrants and immigrants. And why wouldn't they try that? Why wouldn't they do that? But you see, the way the government has handled it is so bad. I live in Wicklow and we've had these major protests in Newtown Mount Kennedy. Now, the Department of Integration has brought asylum seekers down there anyway. But what they're doing is they're concentrating on putting in large numbers of single men. And that is going to disrupt any small village or town in any county in Ireland. They have done it already in Wicklow Town. There were major protests in Aucrim the other day, although the owners of the hotel said no, they're not doing it.
Is there much in the way of choice, given that I would have assumed that when people migrate for pressures of safety or for pressures of economic reasons, it tends to be single men who lead the vanguard? If you look at Ireland in the 50s, it was single men who went to Manchester and Liverpool and worked and returned money back home.
Well, they're not seeking asylum. I mean, that's the issue. Like, they're not coming here. I suppose the issue, the government will tell you, they're not coming here as economic migrants. Because if you were, you'd be getting a visa, you know, you're trying to get a work arrangement, but you're seeking international protection. And what the government is telling us is that a lot of them are not entitled to it.
Yeah, and I think also we're looking at the wrong kinds of accommodation. I mean, the Ukrainian situation now is totally different. And I know a lot of people volunteered as hosts, and that's worked out very well in the main. But in Germany, in, say, 1980, around the time of the Berlin Wall or just after it, they had a huge influx of migrants, a lot of them coming from Turkey. And how they handled it, and very successfully, you didn't just arrive and put up a tent somewhere. You were admitted until they looked at your situation, decided you could stay. But they established these huge camps. Now, we have the facility for that, but we're not using them. And you stayed in that camp for 6 months. You didn't leave it. And you learned about German culture. You had to become proficient in the German language. And after 6 months, you had to pass an exam. And if you were deemed then suitable, you were sent, you were given a home, whatever, and sent to a certain area of Germany, not maybe where you wanted to go. But I mean, in our case, what we should be doing is taking over places like Spike Island, military barracks, keeping all these people together and giving them what they're actually saying they're asking for, which is safety, a hot shower, a bed, food. We can give them that on a short-term basis. And there has to be, you know, give
Although
and take in this.
Although any time that we have done that, those areas have become flashpoints. Admittedly, we haven't done it on islands, but where we have used hotels in communities or we've used public buildings, they become the flashpoints.
Yes, but let's not use hotels. Let's go out there and open the barracks, and which half of which are empty anyway. And Spike Island, I mean, it's about 20 acres down in Spike Island of buildings. It's a huge fort.
But how are people supposed to integrate if you're putting them out onto an island?
No, you don't integrate in the beginning. I believe that you come, you find out about the country, we find out about you, and then we make much quicker decisions as to whether or not you're going to stay. And if you're going to stay, we give you every support possible and we get you out there into the community. I mean, you don't arrive day one and say, you know, I'm fleeing for my life, I need a bed, I need hot food, I need a place to stay, and I want to integrate. That comes a bit later.
Okay, just remind people that's Valerie Cox, journalist and broadcaster. We have with us as well from the Independent, their news reporter, Gavia Gadafiscacha, and we have Jared Howland, Public Affairs Advisor. Jared, you want to come in?
Yes, just to say about what Valerie's saying, the irony is that the government largely agrees with her, although only very belatedly and very recently, that if you look at Roderick O'Gorman's plan that was approved at Cabinet a few weeks ago, a lot of the elements of what Valerie's outlined, which are the norm in Germany and other places, are part of that plan. We would have much fewer, much bigger state-owned facilities where we'd have much more supports in them. The problem with that plan, which is a few weeks old, which will not be implemented in the life of this government, is the ingredients of it were on the table within government 2 and 3 years ago.
So what do we now do? Because we have to add into the mix the effect of the UK's Rwanda policy, which, depending on who you believe, has had no effect at all because it isn't in operation, or has had a catastrophic effect and is forcing people to come across the land border from Northern Ireland.
Well, we have the common travel area and we're in the EU, and Britain is now out of the EU, and Britain is facing into an election. It had local elections on Friday. It will have a general election, if not before the summer, shortly thereafter. And what is driving this in Britain is no concern about Ireland. We're not on their map mentally whatsoever. This is the Conservative Party trying, first of all, to stave off the Labour Party, but particularly to stave off reform, because the Labour Party could successfully drive the Tories back to their own heartlands, but the Reform Party could eat the Tory Party alive in those heartlands. So,
is the net effect of that not a doubling down on the kind of belligerent language we've seen from Mr. Sunak, where he is saying, proof of the pudding, look at all the refugees headed for Ireland.
And we are one of a smorgasbord of issues, including the civil service, which is part of the leftish deep state, including the BBC, Ireland immigration. There's a whole selection of issues of which we are only one. We are completely happenstance. And there is no cure for this side of a British election, which is months away.
Gabeira, did you want to come in on that?
Yeah, and I think that certainly that played out this week. I mean, that was the row that we had with the Tory government this week certainly wasn't very helpful. And even all across the papers, you know, senior sources across government are acknowledging that, like, this is not good for Anglo-Irish relations. It's not how we do Anglo-Irish relations. It doesn't, you know, help Ireland in any way. It doesn't particularly help the UK either. But, you know, even when you look at Monday, when I was on duty, and, you know, suddenly this spat emerges where James Cleverly, Helen McEntee's British counterpart, he snubbed her. He was supposed to meet her at this conference in London. He's actually got a diary clash now all of a sudden. Then she's saying, fine, I'm not going to the conference at all. And it's just Chris Heaton-Harris and Micheál Martin left to do some of the hard work on that front. You know, government sources out saying, oh, sure, the Tories are only, you know, their elections are coming up this week, and it's just all a load of nonsense what Rishi Sunak is saying about, oh, well, our Rwanda policy is working if people are going to Ireland. Like, it just leaves Ireland in a very difficult position. And also, when you have Helen McEntee bringing plans to Cabinet to draft these laws to make the UK a safe country so that people can be deported back to it, you know, if needs be, if they're found to be if their asylum applications are found to be invalid here, you know, the UK are saying we're not going to enter any sort of a returns agreement.
And it all seems
and why
to be,
should they?
According to John Lee in the Irish Mail on Sunday, this is now boiling over in Cabinet, with Cabinet ministers having a go at each other and calling each other juvenile.
Yes, and certainly calling the Taoiseach a juvenile. And of course, Simon Harris has only got his feet under the desk for the past few weeks. And so perhaps maybe he is juvenile in some of the things that he's doing. But I thought it was interesting how quickly this row started to develop with the Brits. And then we have all the attention being diverted to Mount Street and this huge operation that was led by the Taoiseach that started to be hatched.
Well, let me go back for a bit, just because I want to clarify for people who may not have read it what the issue with the row is. Because we are told by John Lee that Harris said things like, I'm not getting involved in British politics, and I'm very well aware there's local elections due in the UK, and I've no interest, as the Taoiseach of this country, of being involved in day-to-day back and forth in the House of Commons. This, John Lee reports, according to his cabinet colleagues, was unwise. I thought some of the language was kind of juvenile, talking about the loophole in other jurisdictions and so forth. And there then seems to be a battle about whether it's Micheál Martin's fault because he mentioned the Rwanda policy, or Simon Harris's fault for poking the bear across the water in relation to their local elections.
Yeah, well, of course, it's all finger pointing. And of course, you know, Fianna Fáil will tell you, well, it's not, you know, Micheál Martin didn't do anything wrong and it's all Helen McEntee's fault. Like, I actually thought that Helen McEntee and Micheál Martin were speaking off the same hymn sheet, in fairness, on the 80% figure, because she came out, she gave the figure, then he came out later on, he said it's not based on statistics. Okay, that doesn't sound good. But the Department of Justice came out and said it's not based on statistics. It's based on anecdotal evidence that's collected from, you know, civil servants working at IPASS, and that's not written down. So, like, I don't, that to me is all part of the one narrative.
So the rest of this is then, it's then detailed further within John Lee's piece. Cabinet Minister supportive of Mr. Harris said, those who made the most damaging statements were the Taoiseach and Helen McEntee. It was Micheál who essentially kicked off the whole thing by raising the possibility that an influx of refugees to Ireland was being caused by Britain's Rwanda policy. We haven't had this kind of internecine battle in cabinet in a while, Valerie.
No, and I mean, Rishi Sunak must have been delighted with it, especially in election week. But I mean, if we look at this European Asylum Pact, which we might be going into, I mean, it's pointless, really. And all we're doing is setting up a system where we're going to be moving asylum seekers like on a chessboard from maybe Ireland to the UK, to the UK, to Europe, dare I say Rwanda. And, you know, it's an absolutely pointless exercise because these people, and remember, you know, there are people coming here who are in the most dire stages of their life. They're having a horrible time. And they should be dealt with sympathetically. But that's never going to happen if we're going to go into a pact like this. We're going to have to take responsibility, set up proper facilities for dealing with them, for, you know, processing their applications. And I mean, the UK is certainly not blameless in this either. I'm just reading the reports of the people who've actually admitted to coming via the UK. I mean, there's one gentleman there, he was interviewed, and he said he'd been living homeless in the UK for 9 years, but the threat of being...
For
nine years homeless on the streets of the UK, but the threat of Rwanda, he decided he'd come to Ireland. That would be much safer. But I mean, these stories in the overall picture don't really matter. The point is that they're here and we should be dealing with it instead of sort of wallowing in the reasons that they're here. We should treat everybody equally. And the other thing is, why are there hardly any women? I mean, it's an extraordinary thing that so many men are arriving here from all over the world. Where are the women? Where are their wives? Where are their children? I mean, how are they suffering back home if these people feel that they've got to get out? There's a lot of questions there to be answered.
Text saying, Simon Harris created this blame the Brits strategy to completely distract from absolute government failures. Another, the tents must be removed as they arise, so the government in Ireland is being made a fool of. People should be detained till their right to be here is decided in a timely manner and not with office open till 2:30 every day. Another, Anton, the USA used Ellis Island and vetted all arrivals, and that was over 150 years ago. Jared?
It was a simpler world, and you were brought on a boat across the Atlantic to Ellis Island, and you had no boat to get off it until you were allowed. So, you know, that sort of simplicity won't get as far in the 21st century. There are many more modes of transport now. The fact is that, as I said very belatedly, there is a government plan. It's a reasonably good one, but it's completely unimplemented. The processes in the Department of Justice are way behind where they need to be, and the only thing left for the Irish government to do is implementation of its own plan, which is by necessity, it must be months away at least from any level of efficiency that would be acceptable. And in the meantime, the British problem, which is driven by British politics, is something we're going to have to live with for several months.
Yeah. Jared Harlan, sorry, go ahead.
Sorry, no, I just think it's quite a good idea that Roderick O'Gorman is going to withdraw the weekly welfare payments from applicants who refuse to accept accommodation in places like Crooksling or Newtown Mankendy. But he also said himself that it's now going to be the new normal where we have 15 to 20,000 applicants every year.
And if you look ahead to the 21st century in the context of climate change, this is something that will continue for decades.
Well, on the topic of climate change, there's a piece in the front of the Business Post exclusive. They have bannered it. Amazon boss warns major risk looming for Ireland. And it's a very detailed interview both on the front page and then within the paper. But in essence, what it says is if big employers like Amazon, if big tech giants like Amazon are put in a position where they cannot rely on the capacity to build data centres in Ireland, they will pack up, head off and never come back. We will discuss that after this break. It is the Anton Savage Show. With me is Gabia Gadavascacha, political correspondent with the Irish Independent, Jared Howland, public affairs consultant and Irish Times columnist, and Valerie Cox, journalist and author. And the front page of the Business Post today reports that the Amazon boss has warned that there is a major risk looming for Ireland. The story is written by Lorcan Allen. Good morning, Lorcan.
Good morning, Anton.
Now, Lorcan, there has long been a sort of a division when it came to the pharmaceutical companies, where there was a sort of a sense that if they didn't get a good enough price for their medicines, they might withdraw manufacturing. And usually people would say, ah, go away, the two are entirely separate. Is the same not the case with data centres? You can have your data centre wherever you want. That doesn't preclude you from doing R&D or development or manufacturing or anything else here. What's he saying?
Well, yeah, as you say, so Neil Morris is the head of Amazon here in Ireland, and he's the head of their entire European data centre infrastructure, cloud infrastructure. A lot of the tech companies typically don't speak out in Ireland. They kind of classify themselves as good neighbours because they're US multinationals and they keep their head down and be quiet. But I think they're growing so increasingly frustrated that they cannot grow in Ireland with some of the current restrictions on data centres that are in place, that, you know, this is why they're now publicly speaking out and warning the government that we are going to be moving investment away from Ireland to other countries because we cannot grow here. And these companies need to grow and they're going to continue growing. The question is where they grow. And obviously Ireland's, a lot of our economy is built on our FDI model and attracting foreign investment. So the fact that one of the head of one of the largest companies in the world is saying this publicly, I think is, will have a lot of people in government worried this morning about, you know, that there's that level of frustration in a company like Amazon.
And he's saying it very clearly. You have a quote from him in your piece that says, "And moderate growth is really important to demonstrate to our senior corporate leadership that there is a path to growth over a 5, 10, 15 year horizon." In other words, if they can't point to a capacity to build data centers, Amazon in the States will say, right, we're heading for Scandinavia, Israel, Singapore, somewhere else.
That's exactly it. I mean, that's what's interesting about the interview with Morris. He's saying that he has to make the argument to his bosses in America that they should deploy capital in Ireland, that they should invest to build infrastructure here. And he's saying if he cannot show that there's a pathway to building, you know, more data center campuses for AWS, their cloud infrastructure subsidiary, they will simply move the investment elsewhere to other parts of Europe or to the Far East. So he's coming at this from both he's an Irish citizen. So he's saying, I'd like to bring the investment to Ireland, but unless I can show it, they will simply move it elsewhere in other parts of Europe. So as you say, it couldn't be clearer from that in terms of how, you know, this isn't a facile warning. He's saying that this is really a serious thing that he needs to be able to show the top brass in Amazon that Ireland is open for business, essentially.
And Lorcan, what about the argument that says when you compare data centres to other sources of FDI, the data centres tend to be a dark black box with not very many people working in them, and therefore we shouldn't sweat it if we're not getting a whole pile of them?
Yeah, to be fair to, I think most of the data centres, you would say, they admit that. I mean, they are, you know, light in terms of employees once they're finished, but it's the sort of construction phase and the spin out of when these things are being built, because they are huge investments. I mean, Amazon's say that their investment in a typical campus is about 1.8 billion, and it's the companies who build them. And you can see that in some of the Irish engineering firms have grown rapidly. I mean, when Neil Morris pointed a number of their client companies that they work with to build data centers, some of them have become multinationals themselves now and are building data centers all over Europe because they're experts in it. Have one company has gone from 6 employees to 600. So the employee benefit is kind of downstream of the data center rather than working in the facility itself. There's definitely, there is a benefit when you have that level of investment. So it might not be directly there when the things are operational, but certainly in the construction phase and delivery of these facilities, they do create a lot of jobs and very high value jobs as well.
Lorcan, thank you very much for your time this morning. That's Lorcan Allen, who's the business editor of the Business Post, and he's writing that piece on the front page and within on page 7 within the paper, that detailed interview with Neil Morris, the head of Amazon's European operations based here in Ireland. Jared, whatever about the level of employment, according to the government, the data centres already built are worth about 8 billion quid to the Irish economy. Having a tech giant like Amazon say we ain't happy isn't great, is it?
I absolutely agree. And data centres are a huge opportunity for the Irish economy. They're also potentially a huge environmental opportunity in a positive way. So if you jump ahead to about 2040, and we somehow overcome our infrastructure problems and being delayed with everything, and as offshore wind is on stream, it's not just that we will have more than enough to provide for all our needs, plus all the data centres. We can be an export of data centre materials to continental Europe, which means that powered by wind, which is sustainable here, we are making a net contribution to decarbonisation across Europe. The problem is short term, but the medium term is immensely opportunistic, positively, both for the environment and for the Irish economy.
Never has an aspiration been built on a foundation of so many large ifs, Jared.
Well, no, sorry. The capacity of Ireland to deliver those quantities of sustainable wind power is not aspirational. It is fact. What we need is the infrastructure to deliver, and we are behind, and I acknowledge that. And in relation to us powering those data centres here, they embed them in this economy. They strengthen our offering for foreign direct investment. They enable us to export that data, which everyone and every smartphone, not to mention every laptop, is using all the time. They are absolutely endemic to the way that we live now. You can't order a pizza without having recourse to a data centre.
Well, this is, you'll be glad to know that there is support for your notion. Tech saying, it's staring us in the face. Use offshore wind to power these data centres. It is a win-win. And while we're on the subject of support of tech, Valerie, you'll be glad to know, one says, Valerie Cox is talking the most sense I have heard thus far on the immigration topic, and I have worked in the area for the last 16 years. We'll park the immigration topic for a wee bit as we continue on the data centres thing, because Kabia, this is, oddly, what Jared Howland is saying is what Eamon Ryan has always said. Delighted to have data centres, as long as we have offshore and renewable power, which we all have to admit we're miles away from having.
Yeah, so what Eamon Ryan wants is it to block future data centres that do not have their own carbon neutral sources of energy. And of course, the Green Party is deeply uncomfortable with the data centres. They suck up a lot of our energy. And so I think that that seems to be a rational enough view from Eamon Ryan. But interestingly, you know, this debate over data centres and wind energy cropped up this week, particularly with two of the candidates that are running in Midlands Northwest that are also in the House. They're both senators, Pauline O'Reilly of the Green Party and Lisa Chambers of Fianna Fáil. They were rowing on Twitter over offshore wind. And even a couple of months back, that's, you know, the same rows have been happening for quite some time. Eamon Ryan had a disagreement with, I think it was Simon Coveney at the time, when he was Enterprise Minister, over data centres. Of course, Simon Coveney, as Enterprise Minister, probably would have been, the comments that are in the Business Post today, he was probably very cognizant of that, that that is what these large multinational companies think, that they may be turned away from Ireland if we don't scale up. But Eamon Ryan saying, look, you know, these data centres have to be carbon neutral and we can't just be.
And the way that the piece that Lorcan Allen has in the Business Post is describing it is, and again, I'm paraphrasing significantly, but effectively what he's saying is, look, if you let an Amazon or anybody else go to another country, get a bit familiar, find that they like it, get in the way of going, well, that pipeline now just continues to point at that country, and it's very difficult to coax it to face back here.
To revert it back. And that's the fear that government has, effectively. And when we see even the conversation around corporation tax, for example, you know, what was the argument for keeping corporation taxes low for so long? Is that, sure, people are going to get up and leave, and then best of luck getting them back. They're going to go to other countries, you know, in Europe or on the continent. You know, why would they bother coming to us? So I think that's the fear the government has ultimately, is that once they leave, there's no chance of getting them back.
Interesting text. Why do we have to build our wind farms offshore, which is expensive? Why not build them on all the islands off the west coast of Ireland, somewhere on Inishere? Somebody's taking great offence, especially the uninhabited ones, says the text. 5316, it costs 30 cents, or 087-1400-106 on WhatsApp. The issue, though, is, and Valerie, this goes to the thing of the renewable power. As we now stand, about 18 to 20% of our total output of power goes into data centres. According to one academic analysis, if all of the ones that are currently being proposed were built, 70% of our total power capacity would go into powering data centres. It's a huge gap to close.
Yeah. I think also, though, you know, we're ignoring the fact that we do offer a lot of very good facilities to these data centres and inducements, or they wouldn't be here in the first place. I mean, it suits them to be here too. I know we could be in danger of losing them, and that would happen probably 10, 15 years down the line before they'd actually move. But I mean, that is an enormous amount of electricity. I do think the government needs to get the finger out now and sort that one out. But I mean, they're hopeless on things like this. You know, we do not have a department that looks after things like electricity, energy, even broadband. I mean, I finally got broadband.
The Department of Energy looks after energy, doesn't it?
It's on Adelaide Road.
No, I know it exists. It just doesn't do its job. In January, I finally got broadband and it disappeared again 2 weeks ago. I mean, that is how bad it is. Now, can you imagine running any company, let alone a big data centre? And, you know, the vagaries
of supplying
it. I can
almost hear somebody in the National Broadband rollout plan saying, we are ahead of, because I think they are, ahead of target. They have 90
plus. Ahead of their own targets. That doesn't mean they're successful.
Texas say we need to go nuclear and let all the data centres come. I think politically that might be an interesting one. Ireland has built one offshore wind farm in 30 years. We are way behind the UK and Scandinavia. We want wind farms, but not where we can actually see them. This is the challenge though, Jared, isn't it? It's one thing to have national policy to say we want to go renewables. It's another to convince people you need to stare at a windmill.
Yeah, well, they are going to be staring at windmills if they want to turn their lights on. And have a hot shower, and that's the reality. And the alternative is fossil fuel, and that's unsustainable. So just get with the program.
Is it not just like NIMBYism on the housing
scale? Of course.
I mean, people are saying, oh yeah, sure, build affordable housing, we're in dire need of it. But the minute there's even a slight suggestion of an apartment block being built nearby, suddenly it's a monstrosity and it's completely unacceptable and build the apartment blocks. I don't know where, on Spike Island.
That is
Island,
all
maybe?
Well and done for you, well and fine for you living in urban Dublin. If you have lived in an area of outstanding natural beauty for a long time and you've looked at fields and cows and they now say we want to put up giant windmills beside you, you have a right to say I'd rather you didn't.
Well, of course you do. But if you live in the middle of Dublin, there's lots of people that live in, you know, Ranelagh, Drumcondra, Phippsborough, Stony Batter that also don't want apartment blocks. Like, we can't have everything our way all of the time. And you have to make compromises for the good of the planet.
No, you're absolutely right. But I mean, there's a wind farm off the shore of Arklow and it doesn't bother anybody. Now, it's at a distance, so very often there'd be fog over it anyway.
Can't see fog.
And admittedly, lightning hit one of them last year and burnt it out. But anyway,
God saying it doesn't want the wind farm.
Yeah. But the bigger picture is Professor Franz Ruan of the National Competition Authority had a lot to say about all this in general during the week. And we are so far behind in terms of so many plans. And we have a real administrative capacity here. You had Sinn Féin in London talking about building out a bigger state. But the reality is that the administrative state, which has the building to do of this, that and the other, is really feeble in Ireland.
You mentioned Sinn Féin being over in London. This was at the invite of Davy, the stockbrokers, wasn't it?
Apparently, yes. And they're...
Something that Sinn Féin is doing seems to be working. Because one thing is the Ireland Thinks poll says, let me go to a break. And then when we come back, there's two things to talk about. One is the resurgence of Sinn Féin, because they've had a great opinion poll, according to the Sunday Independent. And also the solution to all of RT's problems, because that seems to be on the way. All of that after this break. I have with me Gabia Gedevascacha, who is political correspondent with the Irish Independent, Valerie Cox, journalist and author, and Jared Howland, public affairs consultant and Irish Times columnist, and the man who will explain why in a single month Sinn Féin has managed to snatch victory from the jaws of defeat and get 3% of an increase in their opinion poll, while Fine Gael has gone down by 2. Huge reversal.
Yes, and it raises a fundamental question, is whether the Sinn Féin reverse is over. It's stabilised and is coming back up on the basis of one poll. It's too soon to say. There was another poll about a week ago that showed that Sinn Féin was flatlining, which in the context of a reverse is positive. So let's see where this goes. It must be quite worrying for the government parties, who are now together in this poll, around 35%. Together.
Can you posit a reason as to why it has happened? Because it's hard to see a single factor where you would say, ah, well, that's the strategic shift that has caused this, or am I missing something?
No, it's hard to pin it down precisely, because last year, what coincided with Sinn Féin's decline was the upsurge in immigration as an issue, which seemed to discommode Sinn Féin and Sinn Féin voters a lot. That has accelerated as an issue. In fact, 41% of people say that that immigration is the most important issue for them now. Whether Sinn Féin has modulated its position, whether the government's failure, which is deepening, to address the issue, is helping Sinn Féin. Regardless, I can't give you a simple answer, but it is extremely important, because upon the outcome of these trends will determine the formation of the next government? Who's going to be at the centre of the next government? Is it Sinn Féin? Well, on 27%, I would say not.
29.
Sorry, excuse me, 29%, I would say I'm not quite sure. But that sort of trajectory could take it there again, as it was there before. And for Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael combined, 4 weeks from next Friday from local European elections, this is very concerning.
And of course, the big trend continues to be the independents, up 2% again, so 19%. So the independents, if you could view them as a political party, are now the second largest political offering in the state.
Yeah, that's a huge number. And even if you look at in that poll as well, in a forced choice, which would of the following be your preferred government, 30% say a Sinn Féin led government, excluding Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil. 23% are saying Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil and independence government, and only 19% are saying what we have now, Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil and the Greens. I will also say, I mean, 29%, like Sinn Féin has been doing very well in the polls in general. There was high days of when they were in the mid-30s, and that perhaps would have nearly secured the bag for them when it comes to government formation. However, even at 29%, it looks like they still are going to have a coalition partner. So the question is now, who is that coalition partner going to be?
I think, too, after the European and local elections, we'll have a much better idea of where they really stand. But I think the voting pattern is going to come into it very much, because in the last election, there were so many people who voted number one Sinn Féin, and that vote didn't transfer anywhere. So that we had patterns in certain constituencies where you expected people just to barely get in, and they didn't. And that actually damaged a lot of the independents as well, who were reliant on transfers from Sinn Féin. And I just thought there was an interesting line from Jody Corcoran this morning in the Indo. He said, at least Sinn Féin would stick it to the Brits. That's what he said. And he said, he referred to the large group of knee-jerker voters, which could happen in this as well. So, I mean, I think it's a totally an unknown quantity, isn't it?
Texts to say, I am based in North Mayo. We welcome data centres, offshore and tidal energy, etc. But we have no roads to get the materials here. We need to get the foundations first before we get the blocks built. Another, how do we become a net exporter of electricity? We are one of the dearest countries for electricity. Who will import from a very expensive country? 53106 at a cost of 30 cent, or 87 1400 106. There is stuff in the papers, fair degree of stuff in the papers about RTE, because there are two reports, I think a Niamh Brennan report and another coming in on Tuesday, about corporate governance and culture and all of the rest of it. The bit in all of this, Valerie, that I'm intrigued about your view is the now suggestion for the funding model is sort of a mix and gathering of everything. We'll have a bit of a licence fee, but it'll be less, and revenue will collect it, and then we'll have a bit of taxation, as you know yourself.
Yeah, you know, a lot of it could be just down to getting people on board and saying, okay, if we go with this model, it means you're going to be paying a smaller licence fee. But I don't think that's really going to wash. The minister herself would prefer to have it paid for by the Exchequer. And also then we've got other various media outlets thinking they should be part of this. And I think that's probably going to happen as well. So I think that's probably a bit of a mess. But I mean, this morning we also have the news that there's 4 million being handed out in top-up allowances to staff in RTE. And everybody's getting hot under the collar about this. But I actually don't think it's a big deal at all. I mean, if you divide it over the number of people involved, 760 staff, and we're talking about it coming, we're looking for an urgent review into this, of course we are. Long service. Well, if somebody is toiling with an organisation for 20, 30 years and they get a long service award, that's only to be expected. That happens everywhere. Acting up. Well, if you look at what acting up really means, it means, for example, that if you take on a short-term job for somebody else, that you're paid extra. I mean, I acted up one summer when I presented Liveline. So, of course, I got an extra bit of an allowance to do that. And you
know, is that literally what they call it, acting up?
Acting up, yeah, acting up. So not like a toddler acting up.
That's what I'm thinking.
Although possibly. But it is just taking something above what you normally do, and you would be paid for that. So you see people who are reporters maybe doing a stint on the morning programmes or whatever, and they would be paid extra for that. And then now the one I don't get is role-related allowances. I do not know what that means.
Yeah, surely that's your salary. Isn't that what a role-related allowance
is? No, this is the extra allowance.
It's the cost of doing your job, perhaps. So, for example, maybe if you're buying lunch in the Dáil canteen.
Or flip-flops.
Is the Dáil Canteen not heavily subsidised? Is that not where you get a very cheap lunch if you were in the lunch market?
Yeah, but you could be eating two dinners a day, as I do be in the Dáil Canteen. Well, €12 every day, you know.
We also serve who merely stand in line for dinner. One final thing before we wrap up, because coming up after the news, we're going to be speaking to the head of the Trinity College Students' Union and to Professor Larry Donnelly about the Students' Union protests, because we've seen protests over in the US, very significant and disruptive protests over in the US, in Columbia and a number of other universities. They have jumped across to Ireland. We now see Palestinian flags festooning Trinity College and tents on the lawn outside the old library. And there are some, Valerie, who might say that this is some of Ireland's richest elite indulging themselves.
Absolutely not. This is what students are supposed to do. They are at a time of their lives when they're unfettered. They don't have mortgages. They don't have restrictions. And it's a time when they can call out the truth, whatever way they see that. And if we look back through history, I mean, I don't know if any of you, you don't obviously remember the 1970 protests about the Georgian buildings in Hume Street, where students actually occupied the buildings. And at the time, everybody was thinking, oh, look at this shower of gougers moving into the Georgian buildings. But in actual fact, we look back now on those 50 years, about 50 years back, and we think what a wonderful job they did. And chief among the protesters on that occasion who moved in to live in the buildings was Marion Finucane. And she is nowadays, I mean, the late Marion Finucane, who is now lauded for the work she did then. And similarly, we had the students involved in the Wood Quay protests. We had anti-Vietnam protests. This is a time of their lives where students are able to do that. And I think it's a very, very important thing. And, you know, I was looking at some of the reports from the United States campuses, and there was a banner there, and I thought it was very poignant. It said, there are no universities left in Gaza. So well, this
Trinity,
is something.
Would Trinity not be better off, though? I mean, they've been slapped with this fine from the university of about €200,000, and I think that was to do with them blockading the Book of Kells because they are protesting against fee increases to courses. I think it was postgraduate courses. Now I stand to be corrected on that. Like, would it not be a better use of TCDSU's time to actually take over Trinity College and cause a huge ruckus over students paying more money? Because Trinity College, if they come under significant scrutiny and pressure, they could say, do you know what, we're going to halt the cost of those increases to courses. And also, I've reported a couple of years ago, on universities and the amount that they charge for student accommodation. I remember in 2019, every single university in Ireland hiked the cost of their college accommodation. And that's not because it was all significantly refurbished or it's all, you know, they provided, built so much more beds, just because they can. And they say, the university will tell you, well, we don't get enough government funding and we need more money. But Trinity College, of course, does make a lot of its money through the Book of Kells.
Okay, well, we will be talking to Laszlo Marnarfi and to Larry Donnelly about this in just after the news. Do you want to say anything quick?
I do. I take on board a lot of what Valerie says. I don't have a particular problem with students protesting or this protest, but I am very concerned about Jewish students and Jewish staff in Trinity College. I think they're in a very, very uncomfortable and difficult place in an institution that served Ireland well for its liberalism in all sorts of situations over a very long period. It is a less liberal place. There is less room for complexity. And in the shoutiness of these protests, there are only one sort of Israeli. Every Israeli is a monster. There's only one sort of Palestinian. Every Palestinian is a victim. And the world is more complex. A lot of people in Gaza blame Hamas for what has happened to them, as well as, obviously, blaming Israel. A lot of people in Israel are very much against what's happening. There was the largest pogrom of Jewish people last October since the Second World War. And none of this context or complexity is allowed any room whatsoever.
Well, we will put that to Laszlo Marnarfi and to Larry Donnelly when they join us after the news. As I say, that protest that's happening in Trinity College, it happens in the context of the Students' Union already being fined €214,285 for protests over the last number of months. And as we now stand, my understanding is that the doors into the library are barricaded, which, of course, as Gabia points out, is a significant source of income to the university because that's where the Book of Kells is. And it's a fairly significant tourist attraction. If you have any views, you can get in touch 53106.
at a cost of 30 cent, or you can get us on WhatsApp 087 1400 106. Big thank you to Gabia Gadavaschetti, who is political correspondent with The Independent, Valerie Cox, journalist and author, and Jared Howland, public affairs consultant and columnist with The Irish Times.
The Anton Savage Show with Kiri's.ie on News Talk.